First, let me thank the organizer for setting up this very interesting workshop and giving me the opportunity to present my work. So what I'm going to discuss today is mainly based on these first two papers written in collaboration with Lorenzo Magnea, Sam Plails, and Stefano Sciuto, who are all in Torino. And you see, it's based on a project that I've been doing with Stefano on and off for many years. So what I would like to do is to start with a review, a very brief review of a very old technique for building string amplitude that actually predates string theory itself. So it is rooted in the dual model approach when people were very much interested in the factorization properties of amplitude that at the time they didn't know were string amplitudes. And I like to present the two basic building blocks of this approach that are a generating functional that describes the generic interaction between three strings, and then an object that physicists would call propagator that allows you to glue together the first object and build in a constructive way more complicated amplitudes that basically resemble the idea of adding handles or boundaries to the most basic Riemann surface to create more complicated Riemann surfaces. So this goes under the name of sewing procedure. And if you perform that procedure in this operator approach, you naturally land on a parameterization of the Riemann surface in the bosonic case that was studied long time ago by Schottky himself and goes under Schottky and goes under the name of Schottky parameterization. And we are all very much used to this at the one loop level, but maybe not very much so beyond the one loop level. So I will have a couple of slides discussion of what this parameterization is and why it contains information about the complex structure of the Riemann surface, but does not make reference to the metric of the Riemann surface. Then I'll discuss why I think this approach was not pursued too much. And the basic reason is that it gives you Riemann surfaces with a particular marking of the A and B cycles. So kind of an Hamiltonian approach, we'll see. And all modular properties that mix A and B cycles are not directly manifest. So it's very hard to implement things like introducing monodromies along the A cycles, which is something that we always need to do in most of the interesting application of string theory. Think about spin structures related to the Ramon case, but even more generically, it also is relevant for the bosonic field. So I will tell you how we tackle this problem, and so that's why we return to this, and focus on a particular example, which is a two-loop amplitude, but just for variety, not in a closed string setup, but in an open string setup. So you could look at this particular process as a three-body interaction between three different stacks of D-brains. And if you did your PhD in the late 90s, as I did, that was kind of a very studied topic because it connects to like matrix model, scattering of these zero brains, brains at angle. So there is interesting space-time information that you can derive from this worksheet calculation. I'll try to give a hint of what this is. So the main reason for going back to this approach is that it naturally can be generalized to the case of super Riemann surfaces. So there is the concept of super Schottky parameterization. And that is what naturally arises if you glue together building blocks that are super disk or super sphere, and you'll see why. So I'll discuss what are the also the merit. So this is kind of the drawbacks, and then I'll discuss what the merits are of this approach. And it basically makes the factorization properties very explicit, because this is how it was built at the very beginning. So you can build a very concrete dictionary between the generation limits of the string amplitude and the field theory integrand. So even before doing the integration over the supermoduli, you can make this relation. So let me start by saying some very, very simple thing. So traditionally, we see couplings between on-shell state in string theory as correlators of composite operator in the 2D worksheet CFT. So this is just one very simple example in bosonic open string theory. And you see here three operators. Two represent massless vector states. So they are characterized by two quantum numbers, the momentum and the polarization. And this is a tachyon. So the only quantum number you have is the momentum. And then the calculation, even if these objects are very, very look like very complicated because they're composite operators, since the theory is free, you can evaluate just by using Vick theory. And then this is the result you find. So this would be the coupling that depends on the quantum number and depends also on the scale that you have in the theory, which is alpha prime. So what I want to do is to stress that you can look at one of these objects, so let's focus on the tachyon, also in a kind of more general way. And you see this by exploiting the fact that this object does not depend on the position of the puncture, and send Z1 to infinity and Z3 to zero. So if you do that, this object becomes a state. And so this is depicted in this way. This object becomes a Bra vector, and so it's depicted in this way. And so you are reduced to calculate the expectation value of this object in two states. So what you can do is you cut this state here, you cut this state here, you just look at this vertex operator, and you can interpret that as a generating functional of our whole tower of three string couplings. Just you change the state you put as a cat and the state you put as a bra. So you calculate a different expectation value. Instead of putting a gluon, putting a massive state and putting another massive state, and you have a different coupling. So this has been exploited to calculate kind of a very straightforwardly one loop amplitude, because you can put many of these objects and then trace over the state running in the Hilbert space. And this is how one loop amplitude are described in Green-Schwarz-Witten's book. That's why Schottky parameterization at one loop is kind of known. But if you look at this picture, you would guess that there is an immediate problem in generalizing these two higher loops, because this state here, if you look at this object, is an on-shell tachyon. So you would not be able to glue two objects like this and trace over all state running. So it seems that this procedure is restricted just to one loop amplitude, because you have one single Hilbert space, this Hilbert space here, and you can trace only on that Hilbert space. So the first question is, can we describe a coupling between three arbitrary strings, not just between two arbitrary strings and one on-shell string? So this was answered a long time ago in the case of what we know now as bosonic theory. And it has a very simple answer. You take this object here, the momentum, and you trade it with the derivative of x. So it means you introduce a second Hilbert space that describes the strings emitted here. And instead of putting the momentum, you put the derivative of x. That's what the most naive thing to do. So now you have these two objects. They are independent Hilbert spaces. This one is the new object. And this object V is basically the set of local coordinates that Arnab discussed before today. So they map the position of this state to zero in a set of local coordinates. Yeah.
So I don't understand the formula. I'm afraid. I'm sorry to interrupt. But
yeah, yeah, please.
I just understand the
formula. Yeah, so what basically, so maybe this can clarify. So you have two different Hilbert spaces. So you can expand this X in modes, right? Just the standard expansion as P log Z plus alpha N Z minus N.
But what is the X of
VI? So this VI is a set of local coordinates that maps 0 to ZJ. And I choose this VI to be a projective transformation. So what you can do is just use the transformation Z plus ZI. That's a projective transformation. And this object here, X, thank you, is just that. So it's the mod expansion, but instead of writing Z minus N, I write VI in Z. So if now let me come to this. So if you see this object here has a bra vector, so all the negative modes here are annihilated. They read the bra vector, so they disappear. So this contains only the positive modes. And if you saturate on the I space, on this space here, right? If you saturate with a state, then you go back to the standard vertex that I brought here. So
you are saying there are two different Hilbert spaces.
Two different Hilbert spaces.
So this alpha n is not the same as the alpha n that we'll be using for expansion.
It's completely different. They commute. So you have one set of alpha here and a set of alpha I here. They are completely independent. So when you put here a tachyon state, right? So what happens is on this object here, only PI.
Is the point where
the vertex operator for arbitrary spacing? Yeah, so this is the fact that now this object here can be arbitrary. Sorry, this object here can be arbitrary. Right? So if I put the tachyon state in the I space, then of all modes, only the momentum survives, and I go back to this guy.
So this is
an operator in this space. And is a big bra in this space, because you see there is a vacuum in the I space. So when you want to find a number, so a coupling, you have to put a bra and a ket in this space, as we were doing before. And then you have just to put a ket in this space. And it's very simple to see. I mean, if just you do it, now you put a vector, you take two non-trivial values, the p and the alpha one.
The state vertex map.
If you wish, yes. Yeah.
Takes the state and it's not a
exactly. Exactly. It implements that. Exactly. It implements, because then you do this integral over zero, and so you get this and zero, and then the derivative of that object. So it's just a way of implementing that explicitly. And then if you do this in general, you do this integration in general, you can write this in this way. So these are the positive modes that are hidden here. And these are the positive modes that are hidden here. And these are the negative modes that are hidden here. And since this is normal order, I write them separately. And then you can calculate explicitly these matrices here. And they are just derivatives of this object. And they take this form. So you see it's just a Taylor expansion of that object there. So what I'm saying now is kind of presenting the reverse history, because this is what was derived first. And then people realized that you could write it in this way. So this is interesting, because this object here form a representation of the projective group. So it means that if you take DNM of one projective B, you multiply by DMK, you sum over M, you get DNK of the composition of the two projective transformations. So this group property is at the basis of the gluing, the sewing procedure. So I've been presenting here in the case when there is no momentum. So like Dirichlet boundary condition, you get on the nose a representation of the projective group. If you work in the Neumann case, so when you have a zero mod, then the zero mod seem to spoil this property, a kind of funny looking object. And then it doesn't appear to be a representation of the projective group because of the zero mod. But what is a representation of the projective group is if you take this object and you put them in the propagator, which takes this form, and in the vertex, which takes this form. So basically, said in other words, this is the object that represents the projective transformation on the Fock space of the string space, right? So it basically does that. So if you try now to multiply this guy times itself, then it will take the same form where these coefficients are now calculated in gamma one composed gamma two, the two transformation. Okay, so this is just to give you an idea that there is a group structure underlining. And then you can try, and these people immediately started doing in the 70s, glue together this object. So take a three string coupling with these three arbitrary states, another one, and then glue them with three propagator like this. And then you expect to obtain a surface like this one. Right? So what I would call a two-loop surface. And it should give rise to explicit expression for the measure. So this would be like a vacuum amplitude. So it would just contain the measure, written in some explicit representation of this surface that is built out of this projective transformation that are in the vertex and in the propagator. So I just would like to turn to describe what this parameterization is. So let me do it in an abstract way. So let me do it for the closed strings, so for surfaces without borders, and then we'll see in one line how surfaces with borders can be trivially obtained. So you start from the sphere as the complex plane plus infinity. And then the idea is that each handle is described by a projective transformation that is composed by the projective transformation that you had in the propagator in the vertices. And these projective transformations that are allowed are of a special type. And I think this is what mathematicians call loxodromic. So in simple words, they just have two distinct eigenvectors. Then this transformation defines two circles, this one and this one. And it's important that these two circles are not overlapping. So if you write a projective transformation in the standard form, A, B, C, D, then the center of the circles will be A over C and D over C. The radius of this circle will be 1 over C. And this transformation, you can check, maps all the points on one of the isometric circles to the other isometric circle. And then it maps all the region outside the two isometric circles inside one of the isometric circles. So you can think that the fundamental region of the Riemann surface is just the region outside the circles, and then the circles are identified. So it's really like a handle. And this is what we have at one loop, right? So comes out. So the idea to pursue this is that, well, if you want to add another handle, you just introduce a second projective transformation. It's called the second generator of the Schottky group that defines another pair of isometric circles that does not overlap with the first one. And then this second transformation will map this circle to this circle. And the fundamental region of the Riemann surface is what is outside all isometric circles. And the isometric circles are pairwise identified. So each transformation that defines a pair of circles is determined by a pair of eigenvectors that I will call u and v, and one single eigenvalue, because the determinant of the matrix is 1. So the eigenvalue is, the two eigenvalues are 1, the inverse of the other. So I can always choose this object to have modulus smaller than 1. And this object here, we'll see, is directly related to the plumbing fixture. So it's basically directly related to the length and the phase, the twist that you do to construct the handle. So from here, you see why it comes with a built-in choice of A and B cycles, because you would call going around each isometric circle an A cycle, and then you would call this curve, which is open in this picture, but is actually closed on the surface because the two circles are identified, you would call that a B cycle. And they have intersection 1. So the B cycles are really like an Hamiltonian, in an Hamiltonian approach. They are generated by the propagator of the states and then being identified under the trace. So in this parameterization, you'll see, you can guess, it's difficult to describe a change of cycles that mix A and B cycles.
I'm sorry, you said several times isometric, but you have actually a metric?
No, it's just conformal.
So they don't have to be the same.
Yeah, I think. OK, you are asking things I'm not very familiar, but I think these are called Jordan curves. You can probably shrink this and enlarge this, and you would define the same surface. But I think for me, it's just easier to choose them to be equal. So just to give a flavor, I will not need these details, but just to give a flavor of what you get out of using group properties and writing what the measure is, I write what the form of the period matrix in a bosonic surface is when you do the sawing with this procedure. And you'll see that the period matrix is written in terms of the eigen values of all the generators. So this is a G by G matrix in a G loop. In a genus G surface, we have G of these generators, G pairs of circles. So the period matrix is written in terms of the eigenvalues, and then it's written in terms of the eigenvectors of the generators. And it's a sum, if you want, it's a Poincaré series over the Schottky group. So in some sense, it's a glorified image technique, right? So you have to sum over all the images that you get by using a generic element of the Schottky group. And sorry, I forgot to mention. So the Schottky group is just the set of all finite products of the generators. So this matrix here is still a 2x2 matrix that you obtain by doing an arbitrary multiplication of the generators. So for instance, in a genus 2, you have two generators. This matrix can be S1, S1, S2, S1, S2, S1 inverse, S1 to the third, S2 to the fifth, etc.
What do the I and J mean?
Okay, thank you. This is already written in a way that a subsector of the elements of the Schottky group already summed. And so you have to sum here over all elements that do not end with Si. Because this being an eigenvector, Si would just leave Vi the same. And so you would have a non-convergent series, right? Si, Sy square, Si cube will all leave Vi invariant. So you have to take away, so this has already been done. So you have to take away Si and Sj as the first and the last element. No, it's an infinite group made out of all possible products. So this is really a series, it's not a sum. No. I think they are completely independent. As you were saying, so this is really a series. So you may worry, is it convergent? And you always have to check, because it's very easy to say things that are not true when you write things that are not convergent. And this is convergent. It's a finite radius of convergence around k equals 0, so small k. Yes.
There are a lot.
Lots of words, yes. Yeah. So this object here, the log of this ratio, is proportional to the multiplier of the first generator, K1, the multiplier of the second generator, K2, power the number of times S1 appears in P alpha, and the number of times S2 appears in alpha, right? So if K is an object smaller than one, this is kind of a geometric series. So it's a convergent series. So this is just, okay, I will not write explicit expression, but as David was saying, you can code you can teach Maple or Mathematica to calculate the first five, six contribution by ranking them in the number of generators appearing in the world. So the words with one generator, the words with two generators, the three generator, the four generator, and so on. So this is a generic projective transformation. So this is always the same. That has two distinct eigenvalue, and there is a funny, it's a convenient way of writing the most general projective transformation with two different eigenvalues in a way that shows that it depends only, makes the dependence of the eigenvectors and the eigenvalue explicit. And these are the definition. So basically, it's just multiplying explicitly 2x2 matrices and two vectors with two matrices.
Yeah.
The Fuchsian case is also our, everything is real, right? The complex structure is not manifest, right?
No.
I'm just saying that they are not 1-to-1. Yeah. Okay, so what is it good for? So I already said that the multiplier, so the eigenvalue of each generator, is directly the gluing parameter. So the power of if you write your string measure in this parameterization, and you expand in this series, you look at one term, the power of ki in that term tells you whether a gluon, a massive state one, massive state two is propagating. So you can really separate the contribution of the individual diagram, of the individual states, because they were originally this object here. So this is the first thing. The second thing is that it's useful to calculate, I mean, to get handle on the generation limit, because when k is very small, the series converges very rapidly. And as we will see, we can have really a one-to-one correspondence between different degeneration limits of the worksheet surface and integrands of the corresponding field theory that focuses only on the massless states. And you will have a dictionary where the worksheet moduli become Schwinger proper time of the field theory diagram. And the space-time vacuum expectation value become the field theory parameters. We are very used to the fact that the coupling is the bev of the dilaton, but you can generalize that, and we will see one such example. And I want to stress that this dictionary, you can fix it at tree level, and you'll get the bare parameters. And so there is basically no freedom, and you have really to get the field theory result just out of the string amplitude. You don't have a tunable parameter to fix relative coefficient. Yeah, I'm talking the integrand, and that still depends on the worksheet moduli. And then I will translate each one of these worksheet moduli in one proper time that is relevant for that particular degeneration. You'll see a picture that. Why do you say so? Yeah, yeah, I will do everything for the fermionic. Okay, so let me come to the key idea of how to use this in a constructive way for interesting problems. And I will use a one loop analogy to say what the idea is, and I will not write two loop formula, even though what we do is exactly the same. So the idea is to use the sewing procedure to build the amplitude when the amplitude, the measure, the particular object we are interested in, when there are no monodromies along the A cycles. So in the superstring case, which means we focus on Neve-Schwarz spin structure. And even for the bosonic state, you'll see that external fields in general induce monodromies. And so you can forget that. You do the calculation when they are not around. The result you get from sewing procedure will look something like that. So this is a product. So this is a one loop case that would come out from the calculation of the partition function of a fermion of weight 1/2 and monodromies epsilon around the B cycle. So if you do this in this formalism, in this operator formalism, this is what you would get. Now, what we do at one loop, we know that this object here is the same as this object. So you just rewrite it in this form. And once it's written in this form, you know how to perform modular transformation that mixes A and B cycle. So you would be able, for instance, to transform this twist from the B cycle to the A cycle, right? Or you can even guess what would be the form with the two twists present together. And this is what Alvarez Gomez and collaborators did in the 80s for the partition function of spin 1/2 on genus G. So this kind of identities is a consequence or is a proof, depending on how you look at it, of bosonization, right? So this comes out from the fermionic language and this comes out from the bosonic language. So the idea we used is to believe bosonization that holds at genus G and find similar relation between products over the Schottky groups and object that we know how they transform under the modular group at genus G. And then transform the answer we get in this kind of less inspiring form into this form. Introduce, do the modular transformation we need, introduce the twist we need, and then that will be the amplitude that also contains twist along the A cycle. So that's the basic idea. So we are very used to do this at one loop, but nothing else than doing the same thing at genus bigger than one. So let me discuss one problem that is the one we focused on explicitly, just to show that it works, and that has this monodromy is along A cycle all over, so it's kind of a real test of this idea. So you can think about the oriented diagram in open strings that describes the interaction between three DP brains. You can put P equal 3 if you like connection with the standard Jahn-Mills theory, or P equal 0 if you want zero brain, kind of more matrix model approach. Of course, if the brains are all identical, we expect this to vanish because of supersymmetry. But here is what I do to get a kind of less trivial object. So what you can do is to boost, have a relative boost of brains. And so that is what was interesting for the matrix theory calculation, or study brains at angle, or switch on electromagnetic field on the brains. Then you have extra parameters and the amplitude does not vanish in general. But the interesting property of the open string is that this is still a Gaussian problem if all these parameters are constant. So if the velocity is constant, if the electromagnetic field is constant, that's kind of like of the Born-Imfeld approximation. So you should be able to derive the partition function as a function of P, the dimensionality of brain, as a function of this parameter representing the boosts or the electromagnetic fields, the angles, and maybe the relative distances between the D brains. So just to have a concrete setup in mind, think about magnetized D brains. So they have a constant magnetic field, an F mu nu that is in the space direction. And then this constant number here translates into a phase, epsilon, that is exactly this twist here. So if you do the calculation in what people usually call clustering channels, so you explicitly sum over all contribution where closed strings are exchanged between these D-brains. And so you have a Schottky group that makes manifest closed string propagation. This twist will be along the B cycle, along the Hamiltonian cycle, because you see the closed strings submitted here and arrives here. And this twist is related to the difference between the two fields, switch on this brain and on this brain. So the question is, can you calculate that object there? So let me just show you what the answer is for the one loop case. And this is by now a classical result. It was derived by Zeitling and Bacchus and Porrati a long time ago. And this is the result for the bosonic theory that I on purpose written in this product form. So this is the result you would get just by doing the trace explicitly over all the states. And this is the result of the fermionic strain. So you can really separate the contribution of the bosonic field, this x, and the contribution of the psi's. And the ghosts at one loop are very simple. They just modify this object there. So this is the result you get at one loop. And it's very simple because you might have recognized that you can combine these objects here, for instance, one of these objects and the sign, and this is theta 1. So you can rewrite this whole result in terms of theta functions evaluated at the twist, at the epsilon. So the one loop case is very simple, and you may ask whether similar relation holds in general. So if this object we are after, this object here, is always written in terms of theta function. And of course, the answer is not, because we know that already the case for zero, epsilon equals zero, is kind of more complicated object. So what I want to do is to say just in words what the new ingredient is, because it's kind of interesting. It appears in many applications. And already manifest if you look at the general property of the amplitude you are looking at. So the point is that from g equal 2 on, there are solutions, there are one form that are solution of d bar omega equals 0, so they are holomorphic one form, that have non-trivial periodicities. So they are g minus 1 of those. So the case g equal 2 is the first time you see the existence of that of those zero modes. And you might guess that what played the role of tau, which was the integral along the B cycle of the standard abelian differential, now becomes the integral over this new twisted differential. That's the object that takes the place of this sine pi epsilon tau at two loops. So, okay, it's a bit tricky to define this object here because, okay, if there are questions, I can say more. But the idea is the sewing procedure gives you this object written as a Poincaré series over the Schottky group. Just gives you an expression. And you can check that it has the right monodromies and it has the period you expect, and then you can calculate the periods along the periodic cycles. Of course, that's the only thing that makes sense. And then once you calculate the period of this object on the periodic cycles, it basically takes the place of this object here. So I will not say more, it's just that this is the technically the part that took us more time because we wanted to find a computationally convenient way to calculate this determinant. And we used some formula by Antoniadis, Narayan, and Taylor that found this prime differential in a different context, but okay. And then they pointed out that Riemann bilinear identities in this case give you some useful way to rewrite this determinant. And so this is what we used. Okay, so in the last 10 minutes, what I want to say is how this whole procedure can be uplifted in the case of a super Riemann surface, and how it can be used to write a superstring amplitude. So the idea is that, okay, when we want to do superstring, the most convenient form for this approach is just to use Schubert-Schottky group, which means instead of starting from the sphere written as a projective plane, add an extra fermionic coordinate. So this is a 1-1 set of coordinates. So this is fermionic that I write in a projective way. So z is z1 divided z2, and zeta is z hat divided by z2. And then the super projective transformation are written exactly as before. So nothing has changed, except you see everything is bold. So just this anti-symmetric form that tells you how to multiply two objects now is contains three entries. And these objects here are fermionic. No, thanks. Sorry. This call it sigma. Let me come to this. So what happened is that in the bosonic case, this was a 2x2 matrix. So this object that is a sign related to the ambiguity of the square root was completely not relevant because the actual group is PSL2C. So a transformation and minus the transformation realizes the same projective, a matrix and minus the matrix realize the same projective transformation. Now this is a 3x3 matrix. And if you write the simplest one, where the eigenvectors are in the infinity and zero, it takes this form, square root of k, one of square root of k, one. So the sign here is relevant. You cannot take it away. And that object here is the Neve-Schwarz spin structure. So you can choose it plus or minus, and these are the Neve-Schwarz spin structure. You can repeat the whole whole machinery, and you land on an explicit in the sense that each of these objects is written in terms of series or products over the Schottky group, and I separated the scalar contribution. So this means the fields that are orthogonal to the brain, the fields parallel to the brain, the ghost field. And these are the three bosonic moduli, and these are the two fermionic moduli. So the important point here is that it's ambiguous to define what the three bosonic moduli are. And in this formalism, you see it because let's look at genus two, so this three-body problem. So we have two generators. And then, contrary to what happens for the normal projective group, you have two different quartic superinvariants that you can perform, you can construct with the four fixed points. And these two different quartic superinvariants differ by a nilpotent term, bosonic, but nilpotent, meaning that it's quadratic in this object here. So this basically relies on the fact that there exists a single fermionic superinvariant with 3 points, something that does not happen in the conformal case, but is a peculiarity of the superconformal case. So this basically tells you that depending on how you define, as Witten was explaining, how you define your Bersenne integration, so what moduli you keep fixed, what bosonic moduli you keep fixed while you are performing the fermionic moduli, you can get different integrands that differ by a total derivative. So for genus 2, Eric and Fong used a convenient parameterization which holds globally on moduli space, which was to use, so if you put everything bold here, this would be the expression of the superperiod matrix, and was to use as bosonic elements the superperiod matrix. So that's why in their formula you see one of the determinant to the fifth, because that object comes out of the super of the fermionic integral. And so it basically stays as in a scalar theory.
Is what you've written the period matrix of the bosonic Riemann surface or the super Riemann surface?
Yeah, so what this is the bosonic. What I'm just saying is that the super takes exactly the same form, where all these objects now are bold, meaning that they use this formulation here. So what we did is just to calculate the first six terms in around k equals zero, and then you see that you have an expression that depends on the moduli and what I'm saying is that what they did is to use this object here as the bosonic moduli. And this is different from using the multipliers, right? Because you see the difference. So they are the same only in the small k limit. In the small k limit, the leading term, this goes to zero. And so this is the same.
How fast does it go to zero?
Sorry?
How fast does it go to zero?
So this is a power-like suppression in k, depending on the number of generators you have. So for our purposes, it's more convenient, because we wanted to show this one-to-one correspondence with field theory, to use as bosonic moduli the gluing parameter. And they are different from the period matrix at subleading order in K. So the two integrands will be related by an integration, a total derivative. And okay, so this is what I just said in word. And we focus around this degeneration here. So we choose three elements of the Schottky group. S1 will give you this loop. So S1, the first generator, is related to the Zwinger parameter of this diagram. S2 to the Zwinger parameter of this part of the diagram. And then just because we choose the orientation in this way, S1, S2 inverse is the external loop. So this is the dictionary between gluing parameter and Zwinger parameters. And then what we do is just we separate the three corners, the corner corresponding to this diagram, the corner corresponding to this diagram, and then the intermediate region, which would correspond to this. And then as Ashok and Arnab did, okay, for the moment, we are not looking at this. This would be a one particle reducible diagram. We want to match all the one particle irreducible diagram with field theory. And since in the Neve-Schwarz sector, the ground state is still a tachyon, it means that all these objects here have to be expanded at the first order in K. So it will cancel this tachyonic pole. And then in theta and phi. So you just write explicitly each of this term. So this was done by computer, of course. And then we want to match these Feynman diagrams, where we separated the contribution of different particles. So these particles here are the scalars. So this is theory is basically the bosonic part of n equals 4 Young-Mills if you do D3 brains. because we just do Nevesh Ward sector for the time being. And these are scalars, these are ghosts, these are gluons. And I split the gluons in two groups. The gluons Vos polarization is perpendicular to the magnetized plane, and the gluons Vos polarization is parallel to the magnetized plane. And so we have different diagrams. And basically, we match all of them. And just to give a flavor, these are the kind of expression that you get in field theory. And you get the same expression in string theory for a particular value of this parameter gamma that I will not enter now. It's a particular gauge that was proposed by Gervais and Neve back in the 70s at tree level. So they realized that if you want to compare corners of tree-level string theory with the vertices of Young-Mills, you will need to change the gauge from Feynman gauge to this gauge. And basically, what we are finding is that this remains true at loop level. And in some sense, you see, it makes the field theory amplitude simpler, because for gamma equal 1, you see many terms disappear here, here. So kind of string theory likes the simplicity of the integrand. So this is the bosonic part of n equal 4 Young-Mills. Oh, I mean, in some sense, I'll discuss now, but in some sense, think about like what Polchinski did when he did one loop amplitude. So if you do a comparison spin structure by spin structure, right, then you separate the contribution of the Nevesh Ward state from the Ramon state.
Can you remind us in the next page what was Q?
Oh, okay, yes, sorry. So the calculation in gauge theory is done in what is called background field approach.
So A is the background field.
Yes,
and
Q is
the function.
Yes, that's correct. Okay. So A will encode the B, the epsilon. So this this object here, B, is encoded in the in A. So that was the this guy. That's the background field around which we expand, and then we integrate over the fluctuation. And the gauge is fixed. So you need to fix the gauge only for the quantum part, of course.
And QM, QM is like a, what Christian called a D term in the Lie algebra of UM?
Yes, 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 exactly. So this this basically keeps the U1 coupled in the in a gauge dependent way. In string theory, it's natural to have the U1, of course, but in field theory,
even the SUN part of it is non-trivial.
Even the SUN part is non-trivial. I mean, in some sense, doing the comparison between string theory and field theory, spin structure by spin structure, separates the fermionic and the bosonic. Yes, yes, exactly. So for the time being, you see in this expression, only the spin structure for the B cycle are explicit. And so are only 4 of them instead of 16. And when you sum over these 4, you project away the open string tachyon. So you land on the, in both, yes. The all open string tachyons are gone. But if you go to the opposite channel, the closed string tachyon is still there. So in order to project the closed string tachyon, I need to tell you how we want to do the Ramon, which is work in progress. So it really takes only a few seconds, hopefully, a couple of minutes maybe. But this is what makes me hopeful that we could use this also to get the Ramon spin structure. And the idea is basically what I was advertising it before. So what was a stumbling block, I think, in the 80s for people trying to do this is that they wanted to get a constructive procedure, a sawing procedure, that would generate also the Ramon spin structure. And I think that's not possible. Because the group properties are not there. And even if you try to guess product formula like this one, guess what would be the analog when you have both A cycle and B cycle spin structure, you'll see that these do not converge. So the convergence problem is back. So the idea is that don't try to write a constructive form, but use now the superspace approach and start from the Neve-Schwarz spin structure and see the Ramon spin structure as a complex structure deformation starting from the split surface. So put the fermionic moduli to zero, and then you want to switch on the fermionic moduli. And then when you do that, you can do that by using formulae that are easily generalized to the Ramon case. And so this was derived by Docker and Fong, I think, back in the 80s. And what I'm saying is that this type of formula, you see, can have A and B cycle here. So, okay, let me just flash this, and then I stop. So the only missing ingredient that we need to understand to connect all this procedure to kind of standard complex structure deformation is to understand what are, in this Soaring approach, the Beltrami differential. Right? So if I have an explicit expression of the Beltrami differential that naturally arise in the Neve-Schwarz sector from my construction, then I can just do the Ramon sector by changing this propagator here. The Beltrami differential will be easy to generalize. And this was discussed in the bosonic case in a nice paper, little known, by Kai Roland. And what we did is generalize it to the super Riemann surface. And the idea is that generically, a Beltrami differential is always locally a gauge, right? Locally, any Riemann surface can be just written as the trivial one. And so you can see this as the gauge transformation that sets the Beltrami to zero. The problem is that globally, there is an abstraction, so you cannot define this gauge transformation globally. So how do you see this in the Schottky parameterization? Well, you see this kind of in a very obvious way. It's because this gauge parameter is not periodic. And it's not periodic along these cycles that are the B cycles. So from the form of the generators, you can derive not the full thing. This would have knowledge about the gravitino and the metric. That's not something you can do. But what you can do, which is independent of any metric information, is get knowledge about periodicities of this. And so you can calculate from the form of the Schottky generator the periodicities. And so what we did is just to check that when you switch off the periodicities along the A cycle, this formula gives the right fermionic part of the super abelian differential. So just two ways of calculating the same thing, and they work. So the idea is that, okay, we do the super period metrics, and then hopefully we can have all the ingredients of the full Ramon string theory. Okay, so I'll stop here.
How would you proceed if you were asked to determine, say, the tensor structure of the 4.1 loop, 2 loop amplitudes?
Yeah, very good. So as you see, I wanted to start with kind of a case which was non-trivial, but still without external state. So this external field is kind of taking place of the external state, but does not require to use Green functions for the time being. But okay, this was one of the point I would be interested in, is basically to generalize this. I mean, the form of the Green function in the Schottky parameterization is known, so you can run the same procedure. And to me, it would be very interesting to see whether this map between string degeneration and field theory diagram holds at two loops, also for the integrand off shell, and then this may be related to the talks this morning. So in that case, the amplitude depends on this projective coordinate. So every time it's on shell, the dependence on this projective coordinate, as was explained this morning, drops But when you do off-shell calculation, the dependence of this off-shell dependence on this coordinate does not drop. So you have to choose in a nice way. And okay, I think there is a nice way that fits the prescription that we had this morning that was discussed by Lovelace a long time ago.
I didn't understand all the details, but for the case with two Ramon states going through the three channels,
yeah.
As Ashok explained this morning, when you have a Ramon propagator, there's really one fermionic modulus that lives in that propagator. So in the case you're doing, there only are two fermionic moduli on the whole surface, and they would both live in the two Ramon propagators. So you can take the surface on either side to be split, and the fermionic degrees of freedom only in the gluon, which
so, yeah.
Which naively would have made the Ramon case simpler, not harder than the Richworth case.
Oh, okay, maybe.
Because in the Richworth case, you're gluing together two things that are rather solid, because each one contains a fermionic modulus. But in the case of one Richworth and two Ramon states, the things you're gluing together are elementary, meaning they're each split. And along with the you would use the naive effort. You would definitely want to use the. There's no doubt about which case to use.
Okay. So you say there is no ambiguity of defining what the bosonic modulus is because
all the moduli would be completely visible in the gluon. So all the pieces you're going together have neither bosonic nor fermionic moduli. So you see three Ks and two fermionic moduli in the gluon.
But okay. I may ask you some questions later.
Can you come back to the slide on the Feynman diagram?
Yes.
So how can you separate the scalar part and the gluon part? Because they're at the same mass level.
Yeah, very good question. Very good question. Thanks. Okay, so this is based. Okay, so this is based on a trivial observation that is even in Polchinski's book, which is that the Worshitt-BRST charge acts at the linearized level as the space-time BRST charge. So if you write all level one states, even in bosonic theory, you have 28 of them, and then you start acting with Q. So you have alpha minus 1, 26 of them, and then B minus 1 and C minus 1. You act with Q, and you'll see that they realize the linearized BRST with Ghost. So the idea is that each, not just the mass level, but the origin, the CFT origin, is related to a particular type of particle. So if in this expression here, I expand at first order this guy and zero order all this guy, that contribution should be mapped to a diagram where a ghost is running in the loop. And then if I expand at first order this guy and zero order these guys, it should be related to a diagram where in a loop there is a gluon in the in the magnetized plane. So that's why I brought in this kind of unusual way where I keep separate all the contribution from the different sector of the CFT, because the guess was that the origin of the expansion could make could separate different diagrams, and then you just check.
I thought that if you do the computation in an equals 4 in 4 dimension and sum them up, you get a single integral. If you just that, whether that matters.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, in the one loop case, that's the case. So if you do the sum of spin structure, if you look at this sum here, you can use Riemann quartic identity, and write everything in terms of a single theta 1 1. Now, that's true for any value of epsilon. I don't know whether something similar is true for the two-loop case. I don't know, maybe Eric. It's just saying that these quartic Riemann identities don't seem to play the same role at two-loop. Like, for instance, for them, if I remember well, to show that the zero-point energy, so when you put epsilon to zero, vanishes, you would expect maybe this is due to the Riemann identity, and it's not.
On the other hand, what would you do, for example, the four-point function or graviton function?
Okay.
I mean, they are used to show.
But for the time being, okay, it's a bit difficult because you have kind of, even if you can calculate, as I hope we can, all the spin structure by deforming, you have the single contribution. They would be written in a complicated way. And then you would like to simplify them. And how do you do that? OK, this I don't know. But if you have a good guess, you can just start checking the complicated expression against the guess order by order in k. As I don't know, like Jacobi probably did when wanted to check the quartic identity, right? You have theta 2, theta 3, theta 4 equal theta 1. You start checking at first order, second order, third order. And then it builds confidence that maybe that's the right answer, and then you can try to prove it.
In the Schottky parametrization, let's say you're at genus 2, what is the range for moduli space?
Okay.
You don't know.
No, I think this is not just I don't know. It's probably not known. Is yeah, so I think that's if you look at this expression, you see that modular transformation taus that go 1/tau are non-analytic for k, right? So it's very difficult to say what happens when modulus of k is around 1. So I think this expression should be interpreted as valid in a patch around the generation where k is 0. It has a finite radius of convergence. But then when you want to read the expression around modulus of k equal 1, then you really have to rewrite it in a modular invariant way, do the transformation, and then, if you wish, rewrite it in terms of product, which is what we do even at one loop.
This
I would love to know, but I even tried at a certain point to derive this one loop amplitude, so this calculation Bacchus and Porati and in the pure spinner formalism. And okay, I didn't succeed, but it seemed hard. But the basic building blocks are just CFT. So if you have a CFT, a free CFT, then you can use this. So for instance, here I wrote these D's are a representation of the projective group of weight 0. They're related to X. But you can repeat the same people did, and this is used in the details I didn't show. You can repeat the same story for the BC system of weight lambda 1 minus lambda. And then you would get representation of weight lambda. Yeah, I don't know. But certainly for a kind of standard free theory, like BC system and boson with a background charge Q, this has been done.
Any more questions?